啊，等阵到我哋啊，怎么去对摩车？马上就面接了吧，这些马上就
面了。我们就说说这些，
就是我们用老家的老的啊，他个的个的，把那个的把那三个的摩的说，
的
啊，他个的个的，把那个的把那三，说的啊，他个的个的把那，把那三个的摩的说，什么先生？你的什么人？先生啊？年头小我说那个爷爷爷爷现在在干爷当到了
根本上了
一年就说在把刚刚到杨大那边头脑那把困的那时候年头就说身边说就上街今天用到了茶菜
路
刚给的现在我如果我没把见面我吃饭没把当面我没把住他在这边等见面这把你是现在把走不上街唐伯德拉查查罗到外者我能生起十几年级工作工作上不会说他跟着查拉查查罗
A verse of salutation from Pramana Vertica by Dharma Kirti also So when I do this kind of Dharma discourse, I first give an introduction to the teaching of the Buddha, and having been introduced to the teaching of the Buddha, then on the basis of faith, based on faith, how to go about with the practice, as I explain it. Why do I do that? Is because whether it's in Tibet, in the past, or in China, and all the Buddhist countries, our traditional people, traditional religion is Buddhism, they have faith in, but they don't understand what the teaching of the Buddha is about. And they even consider all the religions of the world are same, because they have places of worship and prayers that they do. And so the religions are seen to be same. But that's not etiquette. But generally, of course, as I said before, all religions teach love, compassion, tolerance, contentment, and so forth. So in that, all religions are same. So many beings, many people are benefited by these religions. So for thousands of years, these religions have proved beneficial to all the different people in different regions of the world. But the difference between the other religions and Buddhism is the teaching of not selflessness, no self theory, which is taught in Buddhism. I knew a Bihar professor from Bihar, state of India, and then later he took ordination, monastic bhikshu ordination from me. He was a very good monk. Then we had a discussion about the selflessness, and when I said there is no self, I mean his whole body shook, and he said, "What if how do we do things? I mean, how do we go about explaining things without self?" So all the different religions, except Buddhism, does not teach this theory of no self. And a German scientist, neuroscientist, that whom I knew, said, in a meeting with him, he drew the picture of the brain, and then explains that if there were a self or a soul, as explained in some religions, it should be somewhere there in the brain. But nothing within the brain could be pointed to as being the soul, because the brain, the neurons work in connection with each other through networks, by networking with each other. And therefore, he said that the no-self theory taught in Buddhism really fits in with the scientific finding. And then in our teaching of the Buddha, there is the teaching of the four seals of Buddhism. I mean, the delineation between whether one is a Buddhist or not is done on the basis of whether someone takes refuge in the three jewels. Those who take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, are the Buddhist. This is one way of differentiating between Buddhist and non-Buddhist. And then philosophically, from the point of view of philosophical view, there is the four seals, which are that all compounded things are impermanent, that and anything that is contaminated or impure, in the nature of impurity is in the nature of suffering, that there is no self, and that liberation is peace. And so, as I explained yesterday, our psychophysical aggregates, which are the results of negative emotions, karma, and karma are those compounded phenomena in the nature of suffering. And so, things which are in the nature of in this kind of contaminated nature are in the nature of suffering, because the reason is these contaminated psychophysical aggregates are the results of ignorance being the cause, the fundamental root cause. As I explained in connection with the Pramana Vartika also yesterday, through the understanding of impermanence, you draw the insight into suffering nature of things, and from there the selflessness and so forth. And so, as long as things come about are contaminated, which means that come about through causes which are ignorance and negative emotions and karma, they are in the nature of suffering. But the question you may ask is it possible to overcome suffering? And the answer is yes. Because the root of all this suffering is ignorance, which holds on to things having some independent existence, a self. And also because of our distorted view of some things which are permanent as impermanent, and things which in the nature of suffering as being pleasant and blissful, and things which are without self or empty as having some kind of a clean self, and then things that have no autonomous self as having that kind of independent self. And so, because of these distorted views, we create the karmas. And these karmas become the contaminated karma because they come through negative emotions as well, the disturbing emotions. And disturbing emotions in turn arise through because of our ignorance, holding on to some independent autonomous self. And this kind of self can be refuted, rejected through reason, and therefore you can develop the understanding of selflessness. And with the understanding of selflessness, the distorted view of self will be eliminated, and therefore through the application of the antidote, which is this wisdom of selflessness, the gradually you go through the process of eliminating in degrees negative emotions, and then you reach that of nirvana, which is peace. And this nirvana is the pacification of the suffering in its origin, and therefore they said that this is possible to attain. And therefore, from the philosophical point of view, it is said that those who assert the four seals of the words of the Buddha are Buddhists, and those who assert otherwise are non-Buddhists. And so in this way, when we follow this kind of a pattern of following the Dharma, it is the style of, or the fashion of the way of the beings with sharp faculty following the teaching of the Buddha's teaching. And therefore, if you really wish to understand and follow the teaching of the Buddha, you need to follow this way of following the teaching on the basis of reasoning. And even in the case of taking refuge, to understand the meaning of what is meant by taking refuge, you need to understand the four seals. Usually when we ask what is Dharma, we would point to some scripture. That's not the actual Dharma as such. And the actual Dharma comprises true cessation and true path. And therefore, you need to develop understanding of the teaching of the Buddha, and then develop faith in it. And therefore, for this reason, I usually give an introduction to the teaching of the Buddha. Of course, whether you follow Buddhism or not, or some religion or not, is up to individuals. I mean, there are people who are non-believers, like scientists, for example. Many of them are not non-believers. But still, you can learn the things from Buddhism, Buddhist philosophical views and so forth. But to be a Buddhist from philosophical point of view, you need to understand the four seals of the teaching of the Buddha. So for some people who follow some certain sects of sub-school of Bhashyakas, I mean, they are not able to yet take the teaching of selflessness, and therefore they still have this notion of an inexpressible, what they call as inexpressible self. So this is the Vatsiputras and others who do believe or have that kind of idea or notion and assertion, because they don't accept the theory or the teaching within the four seals, that of the self emptiness and selflessness, and they are sometimes said to be not Buddhist from the philosophical point of view. And so, from the philosophical point of view, those who assert selflessness can be considered as Buddhist, and those who reject that and assert some selfhood or Atman or soul theory are non-Buddhist. So whenever I give the teaching on the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, I mean, even though I may start from the beginning of the text, I do take the first verses from the ninth chapter, which talks about the two truths. In Abhisamaya Alamkara, the first chapter deals with the first chapter is on the bodhicitta. Begins with that of the bodhicitta. So within the teaching, what is known as the teaching of the ten instructions, it begins with that of the Bodhicitta. And then there are the 70 topics that are related in the Abhisamaya Alamkara in the whole text. And with that of the instruction, and then within the 10 instructions, there is the teaching on the two truths in Abhisamaya Alamkara. And then the Four Noble Truths. And so with regard to the two truths, there is the teaching of the ultimate truth, which is talking about selflessness. So in order to understand the unique position of the understanding of selflessness, you need to understand the interdependent nature of things. And therefore, there is also within this teaching of interdependence, the interdependence pertaining to the samsara and nirvana. Therefore, you have the two truths pertaining to the within the Four Noble Truths, with regard to the causal dependence, you have those of the suffering and the origin of suffering pertaining to the samsaric existence, and then true cessation and true path pertaining to the nirvana. Of course, you can still argue that there's some Sankhyas who do not assert any creator God. I mean, because they don't assert creator God, do they also, can we say that they also assert the interdependence? But to this, it may sound that they do assert the interdependence, but when you really look closely into their philosophical assertion, they do accept that of they do assert a permanent independent self. And so from this point of view, they cannot be said to assert interdependent nature of things. And so interdependence or dependent origination is a unique teaching or the assertion of Buddhism. So because we talk about the interdependent or dependent origination, when we talk about attaining a resultant state, that also has to be understood within this the parameter of dependence on causes and conditions. And because things are dependent in terms of causality, we can say that things do not exist independently. Not only that the effects arise independent of their causes, but the fact that something is called cause is because of the effect that it gives rise to. And so with regard to the law of causality, even animals are aware to a certain degree, I mean, how the certain effects can arise dependence on certain causes. So just as an effect is dependent on its cause, likewise, the fact that something is called a cause is because of relation to the effect that it gives rise to. So without that effect, you cannot call that object, that thing, as a cause. Because without there being something that arises, you cannot have something that gives rise to it as well. And without that thing which gives rise to that effect, I mean, you cannot have the effect arising. And therefore, because things are dependent, the effects come from their causes, arise from their causes. There are those of the philosophical schools, like the Sankhya school, which says that the effect is intrinsically within that effect cause. But Buddhism says that the reason why something comes about as an effect is because of its cause. And with this in mind, because the effect is, although the effect is not yet there at the time of the cause, yet, because it's going to arise, that thing which arises from the cause is called an effect. And that cause is also said to be a cause because of the effect, in without which you cannot have a cause. And therefore, you can see this interdependence between the cause and the effect. And therefore, you can see that things can either be dependent or independent. So without depending on others, I mean, you cannot have something existing, and therefore you cannot have something independently arising or existing. So, on the basis of understanding the law of causality, the dependence in terms of causality, then you can also go into draw the insight into how things are dependent by way of designation. Yet, when we see things, they do not appear to us as being designated and dependent in terms of being designated. And therefore, in Buddhism, using the reason, dependent arising, dependent arising in terms of designated dependence, then we can say that things do not have any independent existence. But within this dependence, we still can talk about, I mean, there are two types of dependence here. One is dependence of the parts on its whole, and the whole on the parts. And so when we talk about a whole and its parts, and when you can have a whole independence on the parts, but if you actually break the thing down into its parts and further into the subparts and so forth, you cannot have anything being that whole as such. And therefore, the whole is dependent on the parts. And therefore, in dependence on the parts of it, you can have something called a whole. So, a whole exists by virtue of dependence on its parts. And because of the parts, you can have the whole. But you cannot have the whole apart from the parts. But when you try to dissect that whole into its parts and further break down into their parts and so forth, you cannot have anything that exists as a whole as well. And therefore, you can analyze things from the point of view of how it arises through its causes, and you have the reasoning called the Vajra splinter reasoning to prove that things do not arise through an independent cause and so forth. And also, you can analyze things by virtue of their identity, I mean, from the perspective of its identity, and then also from the point of view of its result. And so by understanding how things arise through dependence, we can talk about creating virtue and so forth. As the Buddha says, do not commit any non-virtue, cultivate a wealth of virtue. And all the different religions actually teach these principles of avoiding non-virtue or sin and cultivating virtue. And then the Buddha says, tame your mind completely. And this is the teaching of the Buddha. And so, with regard to non-virtue and virtue, or wholesome and unwholesome actions, we can actually relate it in relation to the causality. Although virtue and non-virtue do have their effects on us, they impact us, and yet if you actually try to find the identity of those things called virtue or non-virtue, I mean, you cannot pinpoint anything as being this or that. And therefore, in the Heart Sutra, there is the mention of form is emptiness, empty, emptiness is form. Because form is devoid of any inherent existence, therefore, it's dependent, therefore it's empty. And because it's empty of any inherent or independent existence, therefore it's feasible to say, tenable to say that the form is dependent on causes and conditions. And therefore, the Heart Sutra says, emptiness is form. So it's not talking about just an abstract emptiness, but the emptiness of the form. Because emptiness of form is a property of the form itself. You can say, because the form is empty, therefore it's form. Therefore, there are causes and conditions which give rise to the form. And so these two, the form and its emptiness, are not two distinct, discrete entities as such. They are of the same nature. And therefore, it's the Heart Sutra says, form is not other than emptiness. And also, emptiness is not other than form itself. Although they are distinct in terms of conceptual, conceptually different or distinct, but then by nature, they are of the same essence. And therefore, you can, from these, what you understand is that of interdependence or dependent origination in terms of causality, dependent origination in terms of how things, the relationship between whole and its parts, and then dependence in terms of how things are designated, and then the subtlest level of designation, dependence is that of the dependence by way of, merely by way of name. Although things are said to be conceptually designated, merely conceptually designated, you cannot say anything that is designated by some conception is necessarily existent, because for something to be existent, it needs to fulfill the three criteria, which are that it is conventionally renowned, that it is known worldly convention, and that convention is not undermined by other worldly conventions, and that it is not undermined by the ultimate analysis into the nature of things. And so there are basically three different types of understanding of dependence. Dependence in terms of causality, in terms of whole and parts, and then dependence by way of designation. And so when you understand these, you will be able to identify the subtle ignorance, and that it is the antidote to it is selflessness, the wisdom of selflessness. And once you develop that, and it becomes intensified, this experience further and further, then your understanding deepens, and the deeper your understanding and insight into the selflessness or emptiness, then you will be able to weaken your grasping at some selfhood and independent self, and in this way you can progress along that path. And so the teaching on instructions given in Abhisamayalankara on the two truths, based on which you can actually make sense from it, and lead from there into the Four Noble Truths. And therefore, by understanding the Four Noble Truths well, then you will see how the Buddha has taught, given us teaching to actually overcome the fundamental ignorance, and therefore reach true cessation and true path. And from this, then you will be able to find the Buddha to be someone who has actually taught us that path that leads us out of samsara, and by teaching dependent origination and emptiness. And therefore, Tsongkhapa praises the Buddha for that teaching. And as you progress along the path, you go through the path of preparation. You develop the path of preparation, path of accumulation first, and then you go into the path of preparation. And then you see, when you see the truth, the ultimate truth, emptiness directly, you have reached the path of seeing. And that is the point of time when you actually reach the one aspect of the true Dharma, and then when you do away with the certain negative emotions from within your mind stream, you have reached this true cessation and through that true path. And therefore, someone who qualifies the true Dharma within themselves is called a true Sangha. And then you could progress along the path and reach Nirvana and reach Buddhahood. And therefore, with this understanding, then you in the Lamrim teachings, there is the teaching on meditating on impermanence and how precious this life is, and so forth. And you engage in the practices to take the essence in this life or make it meaningful. And then, as Tsongkhapa says, in the three principal aspects of the path, you develop the determination to be free from samsara, by way of turning your mind away from the samsaric existence and pleasures and so forth. And then, you develop this experience of wanting to turn away your mind from the pleasures of this life, preoccupation with this life, and then go into the turning your mind away from the preoccupation with the pleasures of the next world, next existence, and so forth. So in this way, then you develop the true determination to be free. And so through this kind of path of turning your mind away from the pleasures of this life and the next life, you develop renunciation. And this is common to all the traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, whether it's Sakya tradition, Nyingma, Kagyu, and so forth. So, and also the Gaudam tradition, which started with the Master Atisha. And therefore, in the Lamrim teachings, I actually, maybe I'm being too much, I'm rather audacious to say this, but I find that Lamrim itself doesn't really give us the fundamental structure, the whole structure on the basis level, to understand the teaching of the Buddha. Although Adisha was said to have taught the Tarka Jivala by Bhaviveka. His Lamrim, the lamp for the path to enlightenment, doesn't really lay out the foundational understanding of the teaching of the Buddha, although it goes through the progression along the path, in terms of the paths pertaining to the three types of beings and so forth. And so you need to really explain the teaching of the Buddha on the basis of the teaching of dependent origination and emptiness, so that you see the meaning of the true cessation. And then I mean, there are other masters like Rahul, the son of the Buddha, and also there are the 16 elders, and who, of course, they are said to be guardians of the Dharma, but they have not written anything. But we have the writings of the great masters of Nalanda, like Nagarjuna and so forth, on the basis of whose writings we can actually gain a real understanding into the teaching of the Buddha, so that we have a firm and kind of a sound foundation for the developing our faith and the practices. So am I being too much? He's always asking. And Master Vasubandhu even says that there are only two ways of preserving the teaching of the Buddha, only two ways, which means the study of the teaching and the practice. And so to through study, you can preserve that of the scriptural teachings, and through practice and meditation, you can preserve the that of the realizational teaching. And so not by preservation of the Dharma is not done by making some, constructing some temples and monasteries and so forth, but by studying. And so in order to develop the realization within yourself, which is to in the a means to preserve the realization teaching, you need to actually understand what you are going to realize, what you are going to, the experiences that you are going to develop within yourself, and therefore, in order to develop that realization within yourself, to be able to preserve it, you need to actually go through the process of studying and reflection, and therefore you have the teachings on the five clairvoyances and so forth, and developing single-pointed concentration, and by way of developing what are known as the mental and physical pliances and so forth. I mean, through which you can develop those of the five clairvoyances and the five eyes and so forth. And then, of course, you develop, you go through the progress along the paths, like the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and so forth. And then you have to reach the resultant stage of enlightenment. And therefore, this has to be the way we go. We should go about with the introduction to the teaching of the Buddha. Of course, even the non-Buddhists consider that of the reliance on a guru to be very important in their practice. And then, regarding, I mean, this has to do with with the teaching of, found in the Lamrim text. Of course, other religions also consider this kind of human life to be very important to do the practice of their religions. And therefore, on the basis of the two truths, you will lay a foundation for your practice by understanding the appearance and the reality nature of things. And then you go into the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, and through that you will actually be able to lay some foundation of your practice as well. And then you go through the rest of the practices. And such as which are taught in the Lamrim teachings, like reliance on guru, the importance of reliance on guru, and then the preciousness of this life and the difficulty of finding this kind of human life and so forth. And so in this way you can also deal with the principle or the practice of turning your mind away from the samsara, the pleasures of this life and next life and so forth. And then you can actually develop a faith in the teaching of the Buddha, in this, through this process, that of on the basis of reason and not just following it on faith alone. So Master Nagarjuna, in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika, says, Buddhas give their teachings on the basis of the two truths, which are the conventional and the ultimate. So this is what is said by Nagarjuna in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the fundamental verses of the middle way, and wisdom verses of the middle way. So this is how we find the source for our teachings in the treatises, exegetical treatises translated into Tibetan, and then go into the words of the Buddha. Even direct perception of form and so forth only view. Conventionalities are not valid cognitions. Form and so on are false. Like worldly acceptance of that. What is unclean and so forth as clean and the like. And so as was said in a previous verse that there is an argument between the yogis and the common world. And also the between the yogis themselves. For example, if someone within the yogis have realized emptiness in what is known as in the fashion of a generic image appearing to their mind, I mean, they would be undermined seeing the reality itself by someone whose wisdom sees the emptiness directly, and within those who see directly. The emptiness directly, the higher realizations of the higher beings, and those in the higher would undermine, or those of the lower ones. And then, people who may be following the same philosophical system, like the Prasangika Madhyamaka philosophical system, within them also there would be degrees of subtlety in their understanding of the emptiness as well. And so those who have deeper understanding would undermine those with the lesser understanding. And then there is also argument from the realists to the Madhyamakas, saying that if things do not have any intrinsic or inherent existence, it is that nothing can actually exist. Such as the Four Noble Truths, and then of the Four Noble Truths, the Four Truths for the Noble Ones would do not exist, and so forth. And so this is the realist arguing the Madhyamakas, whereas Master Nagarjuna says, your argument is based on not understanding the purpose, the nature, and the meaning of emptiness. The purpose is to stop our clinging or the grasping at some true existence. Savatantrika Madhyamakas say that things, they actually say that something to be existent must be have two the qualification that they exist, that it exists from its own side, and that unmistaken or cognition actually designates it. So with these two coming together, then something can be said to exist. And so still they do assert, these Savatantrika Madhyamakas do assert that of objective existence and things. And so there's some objectification still left. And so although you may have understanding of the selflessness or emptiness from the point of view of the lower schools, you will not be able to do away with this clinging to true existence of the psychophysical aggregates. Although you may be able to reject, be able to say that a self does not exist, as in terms of a person, that does not undermine, that does not affect the clinging to the psychophysical aggregates. So because we hold on to this kind of psychophysical aggregates having some solid or some inherent existence, the sutra says that because the psychophysical aggregates are empty, therefore there is no self. And it goes on to say that when we reject any selfhood in things, it's not a nihilistic idea, because it says, just as a chariot is designated on the basis of its parts coming put together, likewise we have the person or a self, a person designated on the basis of his or her psychophysical aggregates. So what this means is that there is no self which is self-sufficient. Existent. So although with this understanding of non-self-sufficiently existent self may affect our clinging to some kind of a self, yet it does not undermine the clinging to this psychophysical aggregates. You may say, maybe I don't exist, but my body, my mind still objectively exist. So the selflessness in terms of the lack of self-sufficiently substantially existent self, you may gain insight into it. I mean, it will of course help to reduce your attachment, anger and so forth because of this. And when you familiarize your mind with this selflessness, I mean, your negative emotions may be reduced. So the greater, we can tell from our own experience that the greater we think of ourselves more, I mean, the consider ourselves more important and so forth, I mean, there's a grasping at the self more, then there is greater attachment and anger and so forth. And therefore, by understanding the selflessness in terms of this kind of a lack of self-sufficiently, substantially existent self, it may reduce the self, I mean, our negative emotions, but still clinging to the body and the mind may remain. And therefore, just as the self, the person is devoid of any independent existence, we can also say that the psychophysical aggregates also have no self. And the Chittamatras say that the objects of senses, such as the form and so forth, do not have any external existence. But this kind of view of selflessness or emptiness will not affect our clinging or to the experiences that are within ourselves. And so to reduce our experience of attachment, anger, and so forth, which are within, I mean, it does not really help to say that things have no external existence. Although this kind of non-duality, according to the Chittamatra, may be a deeper understanding of selflessness compared to the selflessness in terms of lack of self-sufficiently substantially existent self, it can affect our emotions to a certain degree, but then you can also develop your insight into selflessness further, from which is to say that you can develop this selflessness from the point of view of the Madhyamaka philosophy. And within the Madhyamaka philosophy, you have those who say that things have some objective existence. Because the Savatantrika Madhyamakas, I mean, there are those Madhyamakas who say that things exist by virtue of objective existence from the object side, and then there is this there's a valid cognition or unmistaken cognition which actually perceives it, and they are still left with some objectification in things and experiences. And as long as there is this objectification, there is a basis or ground for our attachment and anger and so forth to develop. Because of the objectification of things that is still left. Whereas the purpose of emptiness is to overcome this attachment and negative emotions. So to reject or to refute that a person exists truly or inherently, you need to realize the person to have no objective existence. Because an insight which cannot realize emptiness or selflessness fully cannot actually overcome this kind of clinging to true objective existence and things. And therefore, the purpose of emptiness is to overcome, to actually counter our negative emotions completely. But as long as there's some objectification left in things, I mean, in your view, you cannot do away with negative emotions completely. And therefore, you need to refute or you need to understand that there's no objective existence whatsoever. And then with regards to the meaning of emptiness, the unique position of Master Nagarjuna is that emptiness means that things are dependently originated. And emptiness does not mean that things do not exist at all. And therefore, when you explain the Heart Sutra saying form is empty, emptiness is form, I mean, it's not rejecting form as such, but that form does not have any inherent nature or inherent existence. And therefore, emptiness means dependent origination, according to the unique position of Nagarjuna, Master Nagarjuna. And then I usually say that you need to understand the teaching of the Buddha well on the basis of the 26th chapter of Mula Madhyamaka Karika, and then chapter 18, and then chapter 24. So chapter 26 deals with the 12 links of dependent origination, and then the meaning of emptiness is explained in chapter 18, and then to really precisely understand what is meant by emptiness and dependent origination, you need to understand the 24th chapter. And then the rest of the chapters of Mula Madhyamaka Karika deals with different topics like analyzing things on the basis from the point of view of its cause and then motion and self and so forth. And other topics. So when the Madhyamakas say that, in this text it says, even though direct perception of form and so forth are there, the Madhyamakas don't actually say that they deny, do not say that they deny form and so forth, the physicality of things. And for example, they do not deny the existence of the table or the book. And if you talk about the book, I mean, it has letters, these words, the sentences, and so forth. The book is not the sentences. The book is not the words individually. The book is not the letters individually. And then when you read the book, I mean, there is the sound of these words. And also when you talk about the sound itself, in general, when you talk, I mean, there's something that you can hear. And without there being an hearing aid, I mean hearing faculty within yourself, if we are deaf, we cannot hear the sound as such. And so for someone who is deaf, the sound seems non-existent. But then that doesn't mean the sound does not exist. So these things that we say, that they exist, such as the sound form and so forth, which are objects of direct perception, are posited or asserted merely by way of renown, conventional worldly renown. So only view conventionalities and are not valid cognitions. So a form and so forth are false, like worldly acceptance of that what is clean and so forth as clean and unclean and so forth as clean and the like. And so impermanence, suffering and emptiness are taught in the teaching of the Buddha. When you are able to reduce clinging to some kind of a cleanliness of yourself or there being some clean self and so forth, so to train your mind to reduce this kind of a clinging, the Buddha taught impermanence, suffering and emptiness and so forth. So it says, for the sake of letting the world enter into reality, the guardian taught about things. In the ultimate sense, however, they are not momentary. And so this means that, in the ultimate sense, means that if you analyze things, impermanent things, you cannot find anything, and therefore momentariness is not an ultimate existence. But that is also contradictory conventionally. So because of our clinging to impermanence as being permanent, impermanent things as being permanent and so forth, and suffering as being pleasant and so forth, the Buddha taught the things to be impermanent and suffering and so forth. And when we relate to the Four Noble Truths, they are called the truth, not because the suffering and or its origin and so are the objects of the ultimate cognition that sees emptiness, but to a certain degree, because that is how the world understands, they are called the truth. And then we would also have to say that things are merely like mirage and dreams and so forth. The convention of yogis has no fault. Then we can say the Buddha is like an illusion. So the question may be that if you have an illusion like a victor you cannot actually accumulate merit. But the answer is from the illusion like victorious one, the positive forces arise because they work in conventional terms. So just as someone may perceive the Buddha from within the perspective of some true existence, so likewise, with that faith, you can accumulate, and just as this this person accumulates merit, likewise, someone who sees the Buddha as illusion-like also accumulates merit. Just as those believing in true things. But if a sentient being were like an illusion, then how could he take birth, rebirth, once having died? So what this means, what these two lines, later lines mean is that things have no objective existence, so that objective existence is rejected. When they use the term illusion, for those who assert some objective existence in things, If things have no objective existence, then they cannot exist at all. Therefore, they say if a sentient being were like an illusion, how can they take rebirth once having died? And the answer is that we don't mean that the sentient beings don't exist at all. But because of conditions coming together, we can talk about an illusion like sentient beings and illusion like Buddhas, the victors. And therefore, on that ground, we can talk about beings taking rebirth and accumulating merit in relation to the Buddha and so forth. In muttering and so forth of an illusory person, there is no negativity since it has no mind. And so when a magician actually conjures up this kind of a magical illusion, because of certain mantras and substances and the objects like stone, pebbles and woods, twigs and so forth that they use. But with someone having an illusory mind, positive and negative forces accrue. Because mantras and so forth lack the ability, cannot produce a mind of an illusion. Even illusory ones that arise from varying conditions are of varying kinds, since nowhere is there one condition with the ability to produce all. If ultimately someone is released in nirvana, and nirvana also has nirvana with residue and without residue, and then there is a natural nirvana, which means that things have no, the mind itself has no intrinsic or inherent existence at all. And because the mind is not inherently existent, therefore you can develop the wisdom realizing it and overcome the opposite of how things really are. This perception, which means that we usually perceive things to have some inherent objective existence, whereas they do not have that way of existence. And therefore, that realization, the wisdom of emptiness, is an unerred mind or cognition, and that can counter the distorted view. And therefore, nirvana is possible because of this lack of intrinsic existence of mind and other things. So the question here is that if ultimately someone is released in nirvana, if there is this natural nirvana, in other words, that the mind, the lack of inherent existence of the mind and so forth, then what need is the effort to reach nirvana? And conventionally is circling in samsara. The Buddha as well would be circling in samsara. What use would there be for bodhisattva conduct? Even an illusion cannot be turned back unless the continuity of its conditions has ceased. Yet, when continuity of those conditions ceases, it does not arise even conventionally. And then up to this verse number 14, it is rejecting those of the arguments or answering to arguments of the realist schools of Buddhism. And next is the refutation of the Chittamatra view. When even the deceptive awareness doesn't exist, by what is the illusion perceived? Verse number 15. So when the objects of senses appear as if they are object, they have some object, I mean objectively, for the Chittamatras, it doesn't have an external existence, but because of this ripening or the reflection of the imprint for that object, it arises, or and the perception of that object and the perceived object arises from the same seed. Like the blue color and the perception of blue, which sees it. What by what is the illusion perceived? For you, if the illusion itself does not exist, then what is being perceived? The Madhyamakas say that the whether it's the external objects, the perceived object, or the perception of the object, I mean, they both are like illusion, same. In actuality, it exists as something else. If the object were to be in the nature of this perceiving subjective perception itself, then you would have to say that the mind sees itself. When mind itself is like an illusion, then what is being seen by what? The guardian of the world, in fact, said, mind cannot see mind. Just as the edge of a sword cannot cut itself, so it is with the mind. Verse number 16 and 17. So since the Pachidamatra say that this object and the subjective perception have the same nature, I mean, that the object is in the nature of the mind itself, they have the same substance. They would have to say that they have the same substance as well. But it is like, just like the way a lamp flame perfectly illuminates its own characteristics. The flame of a lamp is not being illuminated since darkness cannot obscure darkness. Verse number 19 says, for an intrinsic blue to be blue, it does not depend on something else, as does a crystal. So these are Pichidamatra positions. And Chidamatra say that just as the lamp illuminates itself, in verse number 18, since that of the flame does not have darkness, what does it illuminate? Is the question. So there's no self-created blue, which is dependent void. If you say the mind cognizes the illumination of the lamp flame, based upon whose cognition can the statement be made? A mind has an illuminating nature. Since the mind has never been seen, by anyone, even if discussed as to whether it is self-luminous or not, is meaningless. Like the attractive gestures of a barren woman's daughter. So for Pasankikas who reject objective existence things, the object and the perceived object and the perception of that object are interdependent. Whereas for those of the Madhyamakas, even Madhyamakas who assert some objective existence, and the Chittamatra say that there is a self-awareness of the cognition which sees an object, such as a blue and so forth. But the Madhyamakas reject that. And Madhyamakas in verse number 23 say that if a self-cognizing mind does not exist, how can a consciousness be recalled through a cognition? So for the Prasangikas who reject objective existence, there doesn't need to be a self-cognizer, self-awareness, or a perception of a cognition as such, because the perception and the object are interdependent. Because of the perception, you can talk about the object, and because of the object that is perceived, you can talk about its cognition, and therefore these are two interdependent. And the answer to this question is, but if synchronizing mind does not exist, how can a consciousness be recalled? And the Prasangika's answer is, through a connection with experiencing another, recollection happens like a rat's poison. So when you have seen something and later you say, oh, I saw this, I saw this, what happens there is you're actually bringing into this, I mean, that you're actually able to remember the experience of having seen something. And because of that, you can say, I saw this object. But it can illuminate itself, because when with other conditions one sees, by means of applying magic eye lotion, a vase is seen, while the eye lotion is not. So whether it's we talk about the objects or the subjective mind, perception, and so forth, we do not say that they don't exist as such. But what we are saying is that the way they appear to us is something which does not exist, that they appear to have some kind of objective independent existence. That is not how things exist. So those which are seen, heard, or known are not to be negated. Here the conception of true existence, which is the cause of suffering, is to be rejected. And then the illusion is not separate from the mind. Despite being inseparable, it is still impermanent. So the object which are seen or perceived have no essential independent existence, and similarly the subjective mind does not have such an existence. If it were a thing, how could it not be different? And if it is not different, it could not be a thing. Although the illusion is not truly existent, verse number 27, it is still an object of view, so it is for the viewer, but samsara must be a thing as it supports, otherwise it would be like space. So merely because you see some illusion, something like an illusion, does not reduce your attachment and so forth. Because even for the magician himself or herself, what happens is, although they know that the horse and elephant and so forth, that is, that they conjure, do not exist, and they're beautiful women and so forth. But then, to the magician, there is this attachment when he magically creates the beautiful women. So there are different interpretations or understanding of the illusion-like, the usage of the illusion-like, this phrase, from the point of view of Chittamatras or Madhyamakas. And even in the Shravaka Sutras, there are mentions of illusion like mirage and mirage and so forth. So verse number, refuting the assertion that the path which understands emptiness is of no benefit, verse number 30 and 31 are finished, and then now we are at verse number 32. So although things are merely designated by our conception and language, and they do not appear that way to us. But Jerem Buche says that there are only two ways that we can say the things can exist. Either they can exist objectively, independently, or they can exist by way of the conventions that are used, like the language and our perceptions. And therefore, since things cannot have any independent existence, there's no other alternative but that things are merely conventionally designated. But when, though you may be able to say that things have no objective existence, that they are merely in convention, still, when you look at things, they do appear to have some objective independent existence from their side. But when you are able to confirm from your experience that this is not the way things exist, that they do not have any objective independent existence, then you will be able to use that insight to reduce your negative emotions, attachment, anger, and so forth. And thus, how can the emptiness, whose base is empty, stand in front of the mind? And then in Ratnavali, the precious garland, it says that the a person is neither the water, wind, and so forth. And what else is a person? So having said that, then the Master Nagarjuna goes on to say that since a person is composite of the six constituents, the person is designated on the basis of these constituent factors. Likewise, each of these constituents also, because they are composite, they also do not have any true existence. And therefore, it is said that in order to do away with or eliminate this, the grasping at some true existence of a person, one also must, for which you can use different reasonings, like the sevenfold reasoning, you may be able to you may be able to see that the person does not have any intrinsic, true, or independent existence, but that should also, although you may have some understanding of selflessness of a person, whether to check whether that is the final understanding of selflessness of a person or not, you could actually check it by shifting your focus to the psychophysical aggregates using the same reasoning. And if you don't, and you are not able to have the same kind of experience of the lack of inherent existence in regards to these psychophysical aggregates, you have not still not found the ultimate understanding of selflessness of a person. So you should be able to use this reasoning to do away with this clinging to selfhood or independent existence of psychophysical aggregates as well. And finally, the designation, when we talk about the designation of a person and these psychophysical aggregates, and on the basis of psychophysical aggregates, main basis of designation becomes that of the mind. And therefore, you should also be able to draw the conclusion that the mind itself does not have any inherent existence. And therefore, in the Dzogchen, there is this the differentiation between sem and rigpa. Sem meaning the ordinary, samsaric kind of a perception mind, and then rigpa, the pristine awareness, and so forth. And therefore, it is very important to understand, on the basis of the mind, to destroy all objectification by using that kind of reasoning to reject any objective existence. So when you gain a subtle understanding of the subtle selflessness of a person, that will also help to reduce this clinging to self of the psychophysical aggregates as well. So without there being a basis, you cannot talk about a property of that basis, and therefore, since the basis, the beings themselves and the things have no independent objective existence, how can the emptiness, which is established on them can have any independent existence, and therefore, in order to do away with clinging to the objective existence of emptiness as well, there is the teaching on the emptiness of emptiness and so forth. In the sutras, there are the 18 or 16 and so forth, a number of emptinesses. And therefore, nothing whatsoever has any objective independent existence. They exist by way of conventional renown. So we need to understand emptiness and the conventionality of things as well. Because on the basis of the things that exist, we actually develop attachment and so forth, and therefore they affect us, and therefore we need to establish that they affect us because of this perception of the true existence of things and experiences. So if you look at yourself, you'll find that you do not exist. In any of the psychophysical aggregates, you do not exist objectively, independently, but you actually are designated on the basis of the psychophysical aggregates, the body, the perception, the formation of consciousness, and your sensations and feelings, and so forth. But if you actually break yourself down into these five psychophysical aggregates, I mean, they cannot even be found. And then when we talk about the time, there we can talk about past, future, and present. Regarding the present, we can talk about 100 years. A century can be a present century, but that century does not exist concretely because it is made up of its parts, like decades. And decades can be broken down into the years and years and so forth. And so, down to the smallest unit of time, I mean, nothing can be pointed to as being the present as such. And if there is no present, you cannot talk about the future and the past. And so, similarly, a year, a decade, a year, and a month cannot be, we cannot have a present month, present decade, present year, and so forth, without relation to others. So unless things have some kind of objective existence, you cannot have the present moment that we can point to as being this. So we can break down into the hours, minutes, and then seconds, and even within second fractions of seconds. Then you cannot talk about, you cannot pinpoint as being there being this being the present. If that is the case, then how can you talk about the past and future? And how can you talk about the present without the past and the future as well? So when you are pressed like that, for what you mean by the present, and then, of course, we can say that they are just in convention. And, of course, we would have to say, oh, I just said so. And although I don't mean, like, as if you don't really mean it. And so Madhyamaka Avatara says that things do not have any essential existence of and in itself, but that they exist by way of convention. So Gungdan Rinpoche, in his praise of the Master Tsongkhapa, which means a meaningful praise to Master Tsongkhapa, and he has this verse where he says that when you actually dissect something, you cannot find that object, but what you are left with is the basis of the designation. And that basis of designation is not rejected. And because of that, the object of designation, we can talk about the such and such thing having its effect or impact on us and so forth, influencing us. But I think that even that basis of designation must be must be something that cannot be said to be something that cannot be found under analysis. Because whether you are looking at a person or the psychophysical aggregates, what you are actually looking at is whether they have objective existence of them or not. Therefore, if you are left with an objective existence of the object of designation, the basis of designation, you are still left with some ground for the negative emotions. So that must not be there. So when you think about the psychophysical aggregates or yourself, then in this way, I mean, you'd lose everything. There is this kind of a vacuity. And even when we study collective topics, we talk about the positive affirming objects and non-affirming or positive and negative objects and so forth. And emptiness is a mere negation. There's nothing that you can actually, that is tangible or that you can cling on to. As Master, the seventh Dalai Lama, the great seventh Dalai Lama has said, just as the clouds dissipate in the space, within this perception of the emptiness, the vacuity, all the experiences and the appearances kind of dissolve. So verse number 34 says, when neither the things nor the emptiness of the things stand before the mind, having no other aspect, there is full pacification of devoid, in devoid of objects. And so when we talk about the merging of the meditation session and the post-meditation session at the Buddhahood level, I mean, this has to start right from the beginning, even at our level, that we should be able to do away with all objectification and things, that our mind merges with the emptiness completely. So in the state of Buddhahood, while the Buddhas are absorbed in emptiness completely, I mean, they still function or serve sentient beings by seeing the varieties, the diversities of things. And so the mind of the Buddha, which is said to be the perception of the reality, that is emptiness, I mean, that also sees the diversities of things as well, and vice versa. The wisdom seeing the diversities of things within a Buddha also sees emptiness. And so in this way, you have both the absorption in emptiness and the experience of diversities of things at the same time. And so when you think about emptiness in this way, it's quite you get a sense of wonder. And you will actually, if you actually try to gain insight into emptiness from the Prasangika Madhyamaka point of view, I mean, you are left with nothing to objectify. Therefore, all and any objectification is completely destroyed. And therefore, this is the ultimate view of the middle way. Whereas the Savatantrikas are still left with some objectification in things, and therefore this grasping at true existence is completely destroyed, and that comes through familiarization of emptiness, of your mind with emptiness, where you don't have any objective existence in things. And that helps to reduce our inappropriate mentation, and that in turn helps us to reduce our attachment and anger. And so in this way, we can in a way kind of tell that their cessation is possible. I'm not sure if I have realized emptiness in a generic image fashion. But when I gain deeper understanding of this emptiness, it helps to reduce the opposite perception. So when you train your mind further, reached that of the path of accumulation, when you train your mind further in emptiness, you will actually enter into the path of preparation. When you develop the wisdom of the vipassana and shamatha together at the path of preparation, and then you go further into path of seeing, where you are totally absorbed, your mind is totally absorbed in emptiness directly, and that is the first stage of total absorption. And then you go along the paths, and the first from the bodhisattva ground first through to the seventh, and then at the end of the seventh ground, you actually do away with those of the negative emotions, the disturbing emotions, destructive emotions. And from the eighth ground onwards, you actually develop this antidote to the obscuration to knowledge. And then in Nagabodhi's text, one text in the Letha Namje, differentiating the final action or something like that, it says that until you have done away with, you have eliminated the three visions of whitish appearances down to the blackish near attainment, you cannot reach Buddhahood. Once you have done that, once you have eliminated these three, then there is no doubt of reaching Buddhahood in that life. And so in Buddhahood, both the subtle mind and subtle wind both work together, and then the Buddha's enlightened activities actually manifest on the basis of that subtle wind energy effortlessly. So verse number 35, just as a wishful and wish-granting tree fulfills all wishes, likewise to the powers of the prayers, the enlightened body of the victor appears to the disciples. For example, when the Garuda healer who empowered a healing Khan has passed away, that Khan can pacify poison and the like long after the healer's death. Similarly, when a Bodhisattva has passed into Nirvana, after setting up the reliquary of a victor by conforming to the Bodhisattva's conduct, he still performs all deeds. And so, So by training your mind, as long as I think read until the end of verse number 39, you train your mind to go along the path, and then you will reach that of the path of seeing, and then go through the bodhisattva grounds, and then the 10 grounds, and then reach Buddhahood, where you are totally absorbed in emptiness while being able to see with your wisdom the diversities of things at the same time. So we'll have question and answer session.
Uh, Пожалуйста, кто-то уже подошел, готовы задавать вопрос? Ваше святейшество, 2 года назад один из наших петербургских практиков умер. И нам сказали, что он попал в мир богов. Поскольку человеческое рождение является наилучшим для практики дхармы, что нам сделать, чтобы он поскорее вернулся к нам? Какие практики сделать, какую мантру начитать, сколько? И можем ли мы читать все вместе, а потом сложить результат?
Your Holiness, 2 years ago, one of the practitioners in St. Petersburg, he died, and we were a practitioner in St. Petersburg, and we were told that he was reborn in the world of deities, but as a deity, he was reborn.
Yes.
And as the human birth is considered to be the most favorable. What rituals can we perform? What mantras shall we read to make our practitioner to be reborn again as a human as soon as possible?
So generally speaking, karmas are definite to give rise to their effect, and once you have created certain karma, and if it's not destroyed, it's bound to give rise to its effect, and there's increase of the karma. And you cannot change that karma by somebody else as such. And so, but then there are those of the relations that you have with others, like such as teacher-student relationship. And you can also have talk about relationship between two persons who share their wealth and parent-children relationship. Bodhoa has said that if you have some connection with somebody in terms of religious connection, like you are talking about this between a teacher and the disciples, it actually helps when the disciples do certain prayers and pujas and so forth to help the Lama. And because of this connection between the disciple and the teacher in terms of their teaching, it can help. But the main practice that you can actually carry out is the cultivation of bodhicitta. There is no greater cause than this. It leads you away from the unfortunate realms of existence, and it leads you up to higher existence, and then it can also lead you to deathlessness, a state of deathlessness, as Maitreya's prayer says. And so you, the Dharma friends of the Lama or the disciples, should cultivate as best as possible bodhicitta, the spirit of enlightenment, and then dedicate your practice for the teacher's rebirth as a human being and in the next life. So that would help.
Thank you. В предыдущих учениях вы говорили, что люди глубоко социальные существа, но у каждого из нас иногда возникает чувство одиночества. Как нам с ним справляться?
Your Holiness, at the previous teachings, you said that the humans are social animals, but from time to time we feel lonely. How can we overcome this loneliness?
When you were in the embrace of your mother, and you were also given affection by your friends around you, I mean, you have a great sense of being a social animal. But as you grow up and you are able to stand on your own feet, you gain some knowledge, education, and your education is oriented towards those of the materialistic way of life, finding happiness from external things. When you are brought up in such a culture, you are brought up in a materialistic life and materialistic culture, then that, although we are a social animal, that sense of being a social animal kind of becomes dormant. But when someone becomes sick and faces lots of problems, you may have a greater sense of being a social animal. When you go to hospitals, when the doctors treat you with affection, love, and sense of care, and you are happy. Whereas when that is lacking, you actually become unhappy, even in the hospitals. And therefore, we need to go to that root of the oneness of sentient human beings. So I feel that education, the existing educational system, lacks that kind of teaching.
Oh, yes. So let us. This is not actually a present for you, maybe, for your holiness, but if you somehow decide to continue your work with a journey into spiritual traditions, this is a picture from, I could say this is the highest, one of the highest monasteries in Russia of this Christian tradition. And you.
Yes, yes. Okay. Later.
Its name is Optina Pustyn. So it can be translated as Optina emptiness.
Huh?
This for you present. And I have two questions, if you allow.
Yes.
So first is, what is the best to do at the moment of death? What is the most important to how to die in the best way?
As a social animal, Jizogi.
So as a social animal, when you are about to die, if you have an atmosphere around you, which is a loving and caring atmosphere, compassionate atmosphere, that would help. At that time, even if you may be surrounded by heaps of gold and jewelry and silver and so forth, it will not help. Whereas if you are surrounded by loving, caring, affectionate friends and relatives, that room where you are going to, would be, would have that atmosphere of love, compassion, and the person dying would also have peaceful mind, could die peacefully, calmly, whether you're a believer or not, doesn't matter. You can have that kind of a atmosphere. So if you follow some religion, for example, if you're a Christian, you should remember your God, and this life was gifted to you by God, and it's coming to an end, and you just put your trust fully on your God, whatever happens to you. And then similarly, other religions, followers of other religions, could think, according to their own faith. For example, some Tibetans, whom I know, Buddhists, I tell them to have the Buddha's image in front of them as they go through the process of dying, the dissolution process happening. And by looking and gazing at the Buddha's image, I mean, they could go through the process of dying. And if that happens, then they could also have peaceful state of mind. And if you also could make the practice of the experience of love and compassion active at that time, that also could help.
Second question is again about this Christmas. So can we somehow look at the Jesus Christ as an example of Bodhisattva?
That we can say.
Yes.
From the Buddhist viewpoint, it's a Buddhist manifestation. It's a different form, even sort of animal form or different form. And then
so the great beings, the great personalities who have really benefited so many people, from the Buddhist point of view, we could say that they are the manifestations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So in the case of Bodhisattva, Jesus Christ, for example, for over 2,000 years now, for millions of people on this earth, tens of millions of people, he has really been beneficial. So this cannot be done. This kind of service to humanity at such a scale cannot be done by someone who is just ordinary. It is only possible for the Bodhisattvas and Buddhas who have and who are able to realize or make their prayers realize and materialize, and the powerfully.
How can we discriminate between mind element and consciousness of the mind? And it seems that current mind is based upon previous mind, mind of previous moment. So when we say about different levels of the mind, what does it mean?
Okay.
Just recently in south of India, we had the symposium of science and Buddhism. So for 3 days, many scientists were there giving their presentation and also discussions, participating in discussions. So when our scholars, the geishas, and we're also having discussions with them, so for 3 days we had the symposium, and when it came to talk about consciousness, we have the text translated from the Sanskrit, from Sanskrit into Tibetan, in which we find mention of the mind and mental events or mental factors, and then the divisions or taxonomy of mind into 7 groups or and so forth, and then also the different degrees of subtlety within the mind or consciousness. So there are many different types of consciousness that are found mentioned in our literature. Whereas the term, there is no precise definitions of mind or consciousness and the different taxonomies in English yet, in English vocabulary. So I usually say that the English language itself is inadequate to describe all the different states of mind or the different modules and aspects of mind. Even Russian may not be adequate for that. So whereas in Indian, the ancient Indian psychology is quite rich in terms of the different states of mind. And therefore, I usually say that compared to the ancient Indian psychology, modern Western psychology is like a kindergarten level.
Consciousness of mind.
It is very difficult to make distinction.
I think very word of these differences, not much clear like that. So in modern world, I think about knowledge, mind or consciousness or emotion, I think we need further development and need more vocabulary, different sort of identification, different emotion, different mind. Like that. Okay. Next question.
Его святейшество, на одной из своих лекций вы сказали, что в науке о сознании, о уме, есть еще неясные моменты до конца, проясненные. Скажите, пожалуйста, какие это моменты?
Said that there are some questions that are unclear in the science of mind. That there are some questions remaining. What are these questions? Could you please tell? What is still unknown about the mind?
So what I just mentioned was that there is division of mind into mind and primary mind and secondary mind, and then the within the secondary or the mental factors, there are those of the five omnipresent, five determining minds, object determining minds, and so forth. So which are found in Abhidharma Kosha and also the Brahmana Vartika and so forth. So it's not only, we're not talking about the Buddhist texts that mention these, but even in the non-Buddhist texts, there are mentions of precise or different degrees of the subtleties of mind and so forth, because the ancient Indian traditions, where they have the practice of shamatha, the calm abiding meditation, as well as the vipassana, penetrative insight. So it's quite natural that and relevant to have the description of mind and identification of mind into different factors, different aspects, and so forth. So they need to actually understand this. And then when they do certain meditation on where they differentiate between the states of mind within the samsara, the desire realm, and then which are considered grosser compared to the mind or consciousness of the higher realms of existence, which are subtler, and within the higher realms of existence also the planes of existence, and they also talk about the different degrees of subtlety within the mind of the higher stages or higher levels compared to the lower ones and so forth. And therefore, there's a detailed description of the mind, whereas in the case of theistic religions which assert or believe in a creator God, I mean, they are more focused on faith rather than doing any kind of a deep penetrative analysis into the nature of things. They do not seem to have much explanation of the mind and its degrees of subtlety and the different taxonomies and so forth.
Как быть, может разработать какие-то рекомендации по захоронению, ну и вскрытию тела?
In one of your books, I read that when the person dies, the mind, the consciousness, leaves the body within 3 days. But by law, when a person dies, the doctors can proceed to autopsy, just the same day. Does it interfere somehow with this process of dying? And maybe we should come up with some recommendations in this matter to the doctors and make another law.
Generally speaking, when somebody has died, and we see that they would still be in this clear light within the process of dying. It's not only confined to human beings, but it can also happen to animals. So I think this process of dying, I mean, reaching that state of the clear light of dying, happens to all sentient beings. Perhaps there are some differences. I don't know. The texts do not have much explanation. Perhaps scientists could do some experiment on other animals, like an elephant and so forth, because there are differences in the lifespan between animals and human beings. Even within animals, there are few. Some live only few days, and other animals, like the tortoise or turtle, can live for hundreds of years. So because of the different physiology, the different bodies they have, perhaps we could have experiments done by scientists on how long the mind stays within the body of a dying person, even of a clinical death. So when someone dies naturally, of course age factor matters, but generally speaking, someone who has who is clinically dead may be remain in that body for two to three days, but I'm not sure. Perhaps the previous life's imprint and also one's own practice in this life could make difference. In the last 57 years, over 57 years of our exile in India, there were over 37 people who, although clinically dead, but their body remains fresh. And it happened just recently also. So the body remains fresh for weeks, 1 week or more. And so our explanation of the clear light of death and then the scientific experiments, I mean, we could perhaps work together by using this knowledge and the scientific instruments. So there may be differences among different people according to different individuals. So some could stay just for a few days, two, 3 days, and some weeks, as the case may be. So in the text, it mentions that some people could remain in that state of clear light or for eons, thousands of eons, and so forth.
Ваше святейшество, я приветствую вас от буддистов всей России. И я обучаюсь в женском монашеском институте тибетской традиции. И мы изучаем логику и философию. Я бы хотела спросить у вас, какой следовать методике в изучении глубинной буддистской логики и философии и не уйти просто в сухое аналитическое сухое исследование, да, и как при этом изучать и совмещать это с медитацией для того, чтобы в будущем служить и помогать другим людям. Спасибо.
The battery is running out.
I study at a monastic institution for women. I'm studying at the monastic institution for women of Tibetan tradition.
Where?
In Russia. В России?
Джомали.
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 And we study logics. The question is what is the method to study profound Buddhist philosophy and logics to keep it alive so that it does not become like, you know, a dry
knowledge.
Just knowledge, but is a living tradition, and how to combine it with meditation.
Oh, yeah.
So, first of all, in order to develop the wisdom or understanding drawn through meditation, you need to develop understanding based on reflection and conviction. To gain conviction in what you're going to meditate and reflect on, through you need to use analysis. You cannot just believe in some scriptural citation or some sayings of a lama, and therefore you need to engage in study of texts, not just one text, but many different varieties of texts, in order to reflect on what you have studied and heard. It's not just to do for one or two days, a few days, but for years and years. And having done your studies, then in order to gain conviction in the teachings, as it is done by the monks in the great monastic institutions who study for over 20 years, and then recently we had the Geshe Mas, women who have completed their study of Geshe degree, and so which is a historic event in our Tibetan history. It's the first time that women have gained the Geshe degree. And so what you need to do is to gain the conviction. You need to reflect over many years and not just leave it at intellectual level, but to integrate the teaching within yourself for experience. Because if you remain only, as it happens in the monastic institutions, that people lack practice in meditation, although they have understanding of the Dharma, quite a good understanding of the Dharma, having studied for many years. So therefore, they only remain in the realm of intellectual understanding, and therefore I have urged the monastic institutions in South India to have meditation retreat centers as part of their monastery, so that people could actually teach. And the teachers could actually teach their students to from their own experience as well. As I also reiterated this during the last awarding of the Geshe degrees and Geshe degrees to monks and nuns, I have urged them that right from the beginning, when they teach the beginner students, to actually make them aware of the importance of integrating the teaching within themselves while they do engage and pursue their studies. Because the first Dalai Lama Gyatso Drupa has said, if you don't use the knowledge that you have gained through study and experience, if you don't use that to counter your negative emotions, it would be like doing some ritual to avert some spirit, to get rid of some evil spirit which is in the east, while you do your prayers in the ritual in the west. And so your your study of the Dharma would just remain a dry intellectual and knowledge without any taste of it. Experience, and therefore you need to actually combine all three, the study, reflection, and meditation. So Drom Denpa has said that when I was engaging in studies, I was also meditating and reflecting. When I was doing reflection, I also integrate the other two. And when I do the meditation, I integrate the other, the reflection and study as well. And therefore, I am a Kadampa who is on, who has not fallen into the extremes. I mean, who do the, these three practices got divorced from one another. So if you just do single-pointed concentration meditation, and of course you may not need to use penetrative analytical analysis into the things, critical analysis into the things, but when you do your studies of the classic texts, you need really to use your critical faculty. And you need to understand what you are going to meditate on. Because one Lama has said that without study and knowledge of the teachings, if you wish to do meditation, it would be like a person who's who do not have hands wishing to climb up a cliff. So in the past, we have people who say that, oh, now they have finished their Gishi degree, I mean, they attained their Gishi degree, and there's no need for them to do any more studies. They just wrap their texts up and put it somewhere. That must not happen. So some Lama had a dream where they saw that they dreamt someone saying that even if someone may have reached the third ground of Bodhisattvas, they should never be satisfied with learning. And therefore, this is what we should do. So we need to do critical analysis into the teachings. And then whatever understanding you may gain through that reflection, you should actually integrate them in your practice and meditation and not forget that. And whatever you have studied, the through which you learn the different things, when you actually apply them in practice, you should be familiar with the teachings, such as the turning your mind away from samsara and the pleasures of this life and the next life and so forth. So without really having this vast knowledge and how to integrate them too into your meditation practice, it would be like following what is said in Kunsang Lame Zhelong, the words of my perfect teacher. So I think Zabedru Rinpoche, if he were living today, he might have written differently than what he has said in the words of my perfect teacher. In Dharamsala, nearby where I live, there is a school, and I was invited there in the TCV school, and they actually had an exhibition in the school, and right at the beginning of that exhibition, they have an introduction to Buddhism, but they have written down what is said in the Lamrim, starting with the reliance on Guru right from the beginning. That's what not we need to emphasize right from the beginning. Of course, if you are doing some yoga, Guru yoga practice, that is needed, even, especially in tantric practice. Whereas when we are talking about the general structure of Buddhism, I mean, you cannot say that as a teacher of Dharma, you cannot say, oh, you must put your trust in me. We need to make people use reason and logic to find the meaning of the teaching. The Buddha himself does not say that his disciples must believe in whatever he says. He even says, what the Buddha has said is, to critically analyze the teachings and then believe in him. And so I feel that what we have, a traditional approach of the Lamrim and so forth, is more it's like a specifically tailored teaching for specific individuals and not from this general structure of Buddhism.
Как океан бесконечно. Вот некоторые это смущают, поэтому если это так, чего, с какой направлении надо начать учение? Спасибо.
Your Holiness, is it true that the Buddha's teaching is as vast as an ocean? Is it true that Buddha's teaching is vast as an ocean? If so, from what part shall we start studying this Buddha teaching?
For example, regarding the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, that text that we study comprised over 100 volumes of the words of the Buddha translated into Tibetan, and then the Tengyur comprising over 200 volumes of the exegetical treatises of Indian masters, and then the writings of Tibetan masters make up over 10,000. So we have this vast teaching. But when you do your study, for example, when you study philosophical view, the philosophical systems, you need to study the important texts like the fundamental wisdom verses of the Middle Way, so that you have quite a broad and overview or the understanding, and then you can actually study other texts and bring them in to align with this text. Otherwise, if you don't have some understanding of a text, you may look at many different texts, but your knowledge will be rather scattered and not consolidated. And there are many texts gotten to the different schools within Tibetan Buddhism, different orders of Sakya, Nyingma, Kagyu, Gelug, and Chonang, and so forth. And so, if you could study all these texts, you may find something, some interpretation of one great being, and to be based on certain reasons that they have, and compare that with another interpretation, so that you can actually bring them together to see the relevance and the different interpretations. In the Kanjur and Tenjur, comprising over 300 volumes, in order to practice, do a good practice of the teaching, I mean, you don't need to understand the whole of the Kanjur as such. For example, if you were to have a vision of Gyatso Milarepa and ask him, the meaning of all these over 300 volumes of text, he may not have any explanation of the whole. But you should have the essence of all these teachings consolidated. And Gyatso Milarepa didn't do very extensive study of the text, but the essential practice he had done. So he has said that from the ultimate, in the ultimate analysis, or from the ultimate point of view, even the Buddha does not exist, leave alone the samsara. I mean, leave alone those of the virtues and so forth. So he was someone who reached Buddhahood in one lifetime, but he has not studied all of these texts. His master was Marpa, and Marpa's main teacher was Marpa, and then his Marpa's main teacher was Naropa and Maitripa. But these teachers were able, were the ones who have actually gained an ascertainment in the teaching of the Buddha, and then applied them in their practice, and were able to do away with the doubts regarding the essential points of the teaching, and then given the teachings. So within the manner of giving teachings, there are those of the giving the commentaries or guidance by explanation or through experience, and then naked guidance. But you need to have a lama who really understands the Dharma well. Otherwise, it would be a mess if the lama himself is not. Jizumila Rebbe went to one lama who said that he had some instructions which, if the disciple uses in meditation during the day, could become enlightened in the daytime. If he uses the meditation in the night, the person could become enlightened. And then someone who is really karmical, has a very strong karmic connection with me, and that person could become enlightened without doing meditation. So Milarepa thought that he was that third category. He belonged to the third category, and that night he just didn't do any practice. And then the next day the Lama said, "You are not someone whom I can actually help, and therefore you should go to Jizumir Marpa." And so if possible, I mean, you should do as extensive study of the text as possible. If not, if you are not able to do that, you should have, you should rely on someone who actually is able to give you the essence of all these different texts, the essential points of practice without mistake, and then follow the instructions accordingly.
Я несколько лет хотел задать вам вопрос, но я понял, что я не готов. Если вы позволите, я задам его на будущий год. Я очень надеюсь, что вы нам будете даровать учение. И, пожалуйста, я задам. Но я не стал поднимать ваше время и сейчас об этом говорить. У нас вчера произошла трагедия в России. Разбился самолет, погибли люди. И погиб мой друг, доктор Лиза. Она занималась хосписами, помогала детям, ей и всем нам очень нужны ваши молитвы. Пожалуйста, помолитесь за них.
Your Holiness, I have a personal question, but I'm not ready to formulate it properly. So I hope that next time when you give us teachings, I will ask you the question. But now I just would like to tell you that yesterday... there was a tragedy. I'm sorry.
Oji. Kız kovat da
This is about the military plane that crashed in which sea? The Black Sea. So he's ordered to make prayers for those who died in the plane crash. So of course I will have my prayers. They'll have my prayers, and this happened. The crash of the plane crash happens, and somewhere in Brazil or so, because of the deficiency of oil, some plane crashed, and so you also feel concerned for those who died in the plane crash, and you should also make your prayers. As well, as I said earlier, you should meditate and cultivate bodhicitta, the spirit of enlightenment and also the view of emptiness, and whatever positive energy you may develop through these practices, you should dedicate for those. And then if you could, if you do know this mantra of Akshobhya Buddha, Mitukpa in Tibetan, this mantra of Kamkani and so forth, I do this, recite this mantra of Mitukpa, which is also translated as Akshobhya, and a translation of Akshobhya in Tibetan. And so I do recite it and then blow on the remains of dead people. And you could also recite this, and also the Om Mani Padme Hum, the six-syllable mantra of Avalokiteshvara. Thank you for asking this, requesting this prayer, and I will, of course.
Вы являетесь на нашей земле, драгоценный учитель. А у меня вопрос такой. Вчера вы говорили о том, что для того, чтобы постичь пустотность, необходимо собрание заслуг добродетелей. Я хотела бы спросить, объясните, пожалуйста, почему добродетель является условием постижения пустотности? Как? Почему? Тем более, что говорится, что совершение добродетелей без познания пустоты – это акт демона. И еще раз, последнее. Расскажите, пожалуйста, о механизме, почему собрание добродетелей, совершение добродетелей является условием постижения пустотности, во-первых. Во-вторых, ну, тем более говорится, что совершение добродетельных поступков без познания пустоты – это акт демона.
As you said yesterday, so collecting, accumulating merit could be a supporting condition for realization of emptiness. So there was this question about the demon. If you have certain merits, that could be like the act of a demon. So if without the merit, necessary merit, your clinging to selfhood of a person and beings increase. Is that true? So he's always asking whether someone remembers the different so in the fourth chapter of Visamayalamkara, there's mention of all kinds of evil doings of evil beings. He's asking whether someone remembers it. So without the understanding or the view of emptiness, so the accumulation or the merit, in Sanskrit is sambhara, it has something to do with the bodhicitta, the enlightenment of Buddhahood. And so the intense and powerful collection of merit that you actually create becomes a cause for enlightenment. So collection of merit is not just any kind of merit that you may develop or create. So we talk about accumulation of merit and wisdom. The accumulation of merit, the wisdom has to do mainly with the attainment of Buddhahood, the Jnanakaya, the wisdom, truth body of the Buddha. And so those accumulations of collections of positive energies which have to do with the attainment of this are called wisdom accumulation. And then the others, such as the accumulations of merit, are those accumulations of positive energies for the Buddha's form body. But we need to combine them together. And so without bodhicitta, of course, you may be able to accumulate certain merit. And without understanding of emptiness, you may be able to accumulate merit through the practice of compassion, love, bodhicitta, and so forth. Otherwise, you would have to say that those who have no understanding of emptiness cannot accumulate merit as such. So that's not the case. Even with regard to non-Buddhist practitioners who pursue the higher realms of existence, they also may have very powerful virtues, wholesome karmas that they create, accumulations. And even with regard to practitioners within the, amongst the Muslims and also Christians, I mean, there are people who serve communities with by giving education and in healthcare. For example, in amongst Christians, there are many nuns and monks who do that, and they are even serve humanity in terms of giving education and taking care of health more than us Buddhists. And so,
Ваше святейшество, подскажите, можно ли облегчить страдания или трудности другого человека, обращаясь в молитвах к Буддам с просьбой взять на себя частичку неблагой кармы этого человека?
Is it possible to decrease the sufferings of someone else if you pray to the bodhisattvas and Buddhas asking to take part of his bad karma on yourself?
As I said before, if you have spiritual connection or connection by wealth and materials and also family connection, you may do some prayers, but you cannot go to such a length, as you were saying, to take away the suffering of others into yourself. And if the Buddha, even the Buddha cannot do that for us, how can we? Of course, there is some, you can help the others to a certain degree, but bodhisattva's practice of giving and taking, where they take in the negativities of others and give their positive energies, the main purpose is to strengthen their the attitude of cherishing others and weakening the self-cherishing attitude. But in practical terms, it's very difficult to give their positive wholesome karmas and wholesome energies to others, as karma is something that you cannot meet with its effect if you have not created it. And once you have created a karma, it doesn't go to waste, and that it increases and so forth, as we say. And once there was a Kadamp master who was giving some teaching, and somebody was around, and this person actually hit a dog, and the dog cried, and at the same time, the Lama also moaned, and people were suspicious whether the Lama actually felt some pain. But when they actually checked the body of the Lama, there was some kind of a trace of the stick which the dog was hit at the same kind of a corresponding place where the dog was hit, the Lama. So there could be some karmic, strong karmic connection and the conditions coming together that someone like that person could take on the suffering of others. But because it happens, could happen to some one person, doesn't mean that we can generalize this to others, everyone.
Yes.
Namaste. Thank you so much for giving these high teachings to us. I would like to ask, considering the empty and not independent nature, illusionary nature of a person, is there really a freedom of choice? And what does it depend on if a person can obtain enlightenment during a specific life and the timing of it?
That's not good. True. Same thing in Shima. Correct.
Да. Вы могли бы повторить мне чуть погромче, потому что очень плохо слышно, почетче.
Considering the illusionary and not independent nature
That's right.
of everything, is there really a freedom of choice?
Free will.
And as a continuation of this question, what does it depend?
What do you mean? Freedom of choice. What do you mean?
Что вы имеете в виду под свободой выбора?
Like in the what happens, like what action we take, even what thoughts come in our mind, what happens, and what even we do. Free will, basically, yeah.
Free will, yes.
Free will. Free will, of course. I think in Buddhist sort of tradition, I'm a free will in a sense. You see? Free will is lovely.
So, all sentient beings have their own mind, and we have all kinds of thought processes going on, and having pleasure experiences of pain and pleasure. You can talk about free will being there. But from the Christian practitioner's point of view, they may have some other interpretation of free will. So, even though maybe one word, for example, within the Buddhist philosophical system, the term selfhood, I mean selflessness, has different interpretations according to different schools of thought. And so, different philosophical systems could have the different interpretations of free will.
And what does it depend on if a person can obtain enlightenment during a specific life and the timing of it?
What will be the causes for the person to obtain enlightenment during one lifetime?
Yeah, what does it depend on?
What does the person need to obtain enlightenment in one lifetime?
One lifetime. Impossible.
It's very difficult to attain enlightenment of Buddhahood for within a lifetime. So usually we say that we talk about becoming enlightened within one lifetime or by doing practice over 3 years, 3 months, and so forth. And I say these are like Chinese communist propaganda. So then you should actually create many different conditions So someone was in a previous life was a Gautama master, Char Tichoka, and then having done the practice in that life, I mean, those have kind of built up in his life, and therefore became he was able to become enlightened for within that lifetime. Otherwise, it's very difficult for us to become enlightened within one lifetime just by doing some rituals and recitation of mantras and so forth. Of course, in order for your tantric practice to be effective, you need to develop single-pointed concentration. And you need also to build up in terms of spirit of enlightenment and also this understanding of emptiness. So you should actually bring together many different causes and conditions should be built up. So sometimes I think that when we talk about becoming enlightened in one lifetime or 3 years, 3 months and so forth, it seems to be we are becoming rather short-sighted, whereas if I think about becoming enlightened within accumulating merit and wisdom for over three great countless eons and so forth, I feel that this gives me the inspiration to work for others. And so in the process of developing the developing the path, we can do the Tonglen practice, as said in Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, and the more determination and greater the courage you can develop, you can actually work for other sentient beings. Whatever may happen to you, I mean, despite all kinds of difficulties, you will never feel discouraged. So sometimes we become so, I mean, we want to reach enlightenment as quickly, and which I think is an indication of our weak inner strength and determination and courage. So the purpose of our life must be to dedicate ourselves for the benefit of others, and then you can do your practice and make prayers for the benefit of others as well.
From a friend who was not able to come here on your teachings, how would you recommend to start the day? Practically, in the morning.
Hmm?
How would you recommend to start a day in the morning?
Hmm. That's up to you.
Okay.
if according Ajita, that is also
So in order to make your day meaningful, it depends on your interest, your character, your what you are familiar with, habits, and also your knowledge and efficiency, skills. So it depends on many factors. So as a Buddhist practitioner, I think that we... The most important thing that we need to engage in is study and reflection, contemplation, and meditation. When you are young, by doing study and reflection, if you could progress along the path in accordance with what is referred by the Heart Sutra mantra, you should know how you actually develop progress along that path referred by this mantra of Heart Sutra, that yatha gate gate para gate para samgate bodhisoha. And so you should actually align your life, your thinking with the path. You should not be expecting things, the results immediately. As Gongdan Tenpe Dreme says, that someone who expects the results of their practice and meditation and study right away, that's not going to happen to them. As if, I mean, even to the point of, I mean, having no time to eat, I mean, you should not expect to reach the goal in a very short period of time. That's not, you will not be able to reach that goal. For me, it's been 60 years or so since I thought about emptiness. From about the time when I was 15 or 16 and so forth. And then after coming into exile in India, I have reflected on emptiness as well. And the experience or feeling for emptiness or experience kind of grows at times goes by through familiarization. And then it's been for me over 40 years or so since I thought about and reflected on bodhicitta after receiving teaching on the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. Before that, receiving that teaching from Kundalama Rinpoche, I was always thinking that it's very difficult to have the experience of bodhicitta. But after receiving this teaching, as I gave thought to it more and more, I mean, I've been feeling closer and closer to bodhicitta, and I can say that I have reached a point where I have reached the experience of bodhicitta that I can actually develop when I put some effort. So seriously practicing and thinking about bodhicitta, in meditation, and it's been 40 years or so. And with regard to emptiness, 60-something years. So it's not easy. You should not think that these experiences come easily to you. Some texts mention that if a qualified teacher and a qualified disciple meets, then the enlightenment could be easily gained, like making a tzata.
Yes. Скажите, пожалуйста, я 2 года назад встречался с вами и подарил вам красивую мандалу. Она была сделана чисто математическим путем, именно по вашей нумерологии. После нашей встречи, когда вы меня благословили, у меня вот эти 2 года я создал много очень интересного, пишу индивидуальную музыку. Индивидуальные ароматы создаются. И в итоге я сегодня могу сказать, что я могу показать всем, как выглядит душа. Индивидуально каждому. Мой вопрос. Скажите, пожалуйста, кому из ваших ученых, вы очень трепетно относите отношение к ученым, кому из ваших ученых найти их как и обратиться с этим вопросом? Я бы мог интересно дать представление, и для всех здесь сидящих было бы легче понимать ваши великие учения, слова ваши. Довести было бы проще.
2 years ago, I presented you a mandala, which I created using mathematic methods. And since then, I created many music, perfumes, like individual and music and perfumes. I was studying the soul of the person. And now I can say, I can show an individual soul or the mind of a person. Could you please give me a contact of some of your scientists with whom I could connect to make this knowledge available?
Science.
Your science.
Certain field of science.
Scientists from... Yeah.
Hmm. I don't know. Of course, my connection with scientists mainly cosmology, neurobiology, physics, particularly quantum physics, then psychology, these 4 fields. Mathematics, no. I don't know. You know, the scientist, of course, the mathematics, I think, very, 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 very important sort of instrument to analyze these things. But we, I think, from sort of the from young age. You see, we use logic, reasons. So seems to see same effect through mathematics and a logical approach. Seems so. So in any way, in Buddhist literature, also is mentioned about cosmology. Then of course new biology and physics, like quantum physics, and some Buddhist sort of philosophy, some similarities there. And then of course psychology. Buddhist psychology and Buddhist psychology is much, much advanced than modern psychology. So last 30 years, as a result of our serious discussion with modern scientists in these four fields, psychology is concerned, there are many scientists really showing real eagerness to learn from ancient Indian sort of knowledge about mind or emotion, like that. So, that's main as a field. I have some sort of close connection. Thank you. Now I think last question. Yes, last question.
Ваше святейшество, не могли бы вы сказать пару слов о той философской традиции взгляда на пустоту, которая развивалась в школе Джананпа? Таранадхи, Далпоты, и каким образом их взгляд на пустоту соотносится с взглядом на пустоту Нагарджуны и Чандракирти?
Please give a very brief explanation of Jonang tradition
and
Jonang's interpretation of Shentong is same as Master Nagarjuna's philosophical assertion, tradition or not. With regard to the Shentong, extrinsic or other emptiness, there are different interpretations. One version says that the conventionals are an empty, self-empty, and an emptiness is other emptiness. So emptiness itself, of course, is empty of any essential existence. So ultimate truth is other emptiness. So with regard to this, and the Jonang practice comes in connection with Gala Chakra. Whereas in Goyasamaja, there are four empty states that are used. The vocabulary of empty, very empty, and the extremely empty, and all empty. And these four states of emptiness are other emptiness, because here the later emptiness are empty of the previous ones, the grosser. And so when we talk about this emptiness from the point of view of the subjective mind itself, it seems the emptiness is with reference to the Shentong. Whereas in the Dzogchen, there is the nature being primordially pure, and then there's the term Lundrup, which means spontaneously established. And if you refer or relate this to the clear light mind, here again we come to the Shentong, the other emptiness. And then in the Sakya tradition, there is the three continuum teaching, and the Alaya being the cause, in terms of indirect cause, or the In Mangtu Ludrup Gyatso's writings, the clear light mind, the innate clear light mind is ultimate truth, and therefore it becomes the a positive phenomena. So here he's actually referring to the innate clear light mind, whereas in Kinze Wangpo's writing, which was completed by the fifth Dalai Lama, which comes within the teachings pertaining to the Sakya, I mean, Lamde, to the disciples, or so in this. So he says that the Kunshi Gyugyu, the causal continuum is a positive phenomena, whereas the Mangtu Ludrup Gyatso says it's the ultimate reality or ultimate truth. So if we say that ultimate reality from that point of view is self-established phenomena, then that goes against the Madhyamaka philosophical system of saying that the emptiness is a negation. So as Kenta says, this is consciousness, whereas we need to really go into a detailed understanding of these different interpretations and then come to the conclusions according to the yardstick of the classic text. Of course, you should have really qualified teachers who could give these different interpretations. Otherwise, we could have different lamas who may say something, whatever they like to say, and that would be quite right.
So,